Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and this is the Veterans for Peace radio show, Daniel Ellsberg chapter, and it's being broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM, Seattle. These shows can be listened to on the radio station's archive. They're also available on the Veterans for Peace radio show website, which is VFP92.org. So with me today, and I'm very happy to see this, have this, is our four classmates of mine from Klamath Falls, Oregon. We were classmates. Many of us were classmates from the first grade on. So it's 11 years or so, 12 years, 11 years for most of you. I ended up graduating from in Seattle, so but I spent 11 years in class with you. It's interesting for me to have this experience, especially having women comment about their lives, but also in particular some comment about the war and that experience in their life. With me are Joni Duracha, her maiden name, Kathy Cronin, Genevieve Harton, and Mary McClary. To start things off, I don't know, Joni, are you bursting at seams here? Do you want to start?
Well, I started Sacred Heart when I was in the second grade, and I went all the way through to graduation. And of course, it was a great place for learning. I really felt that the education was excellent. Then I went to Southern Oregon College and couldn't go to church every day or every Sunday, and always was told that not going to church on Sundays was a mortal sin, and you had to go to confession so you could go to communion. And so that I started thinking, oh my gosh, how can that be? And I just sort of started getting away from the church. And now I don't go to church, but I have a relationship with God because of some of the things that I've some of the diseases that I've had go in my body, and I'm actually fine. But I think to me, the church ended up being, it was more of a social atmosphere after I start thinking about it. It's where you went and you saw people on Sundays, and sometimes you went to coffee and donuts in the parish hall. And you did the same thing every Sunday. And when I got older, I just thought, this isn't quite right. Why do I always have to go to church? Why is it called a mortal sin? What is the venial sin? Am I going to go to hell? There were all these things that were there, and I thought, well, this isn't right. And so I just started doing my own thing. And I think I'm a happier person right now without having to go to church all the time because I have a relationship with God in my own way.
Yeah. Well, where did you first hear this thing? That's kind of I didn't I don't remember that being a mortal sin if you didn't go to church. Maybe I missed something.
Well, I always thought that that they told you that if you missed Mass on Sundays, it was a sin. That's what I learned in school. That's what I remember.
Really?
That's what I remember. I don't know if you girls remembered that.
Yes, I remember that.
I think
Yeah.
so.
Really?
You weren't listening,
I guess I wasn't paying attention.
I thought. That's good too.
Katie, can you add anything to that?
Well, Jody and I both did it from our grow-me-ups in Sacred Heart Academy, Klamath Falls, which I found very, as I look back on it, a very heavy-duty kind of brainwashing that went on with the Catholic Church and their kind of old church doctrine. So you didn't really have a voice as a female. You had to cover your head. You had to think up sins to say in confession. You had to find out ways to not have a mortal sin, you know. But there was no love, there was no joy. It was all kind of oppression. And of course, critical thinking was kind of left totally out as well. You were told what to do. The Baltimore Catechism was it. You parroted back answers. So I too went through college. My college years all in Catholic schools. But by the time I got to my junior year in college, the ecumenical council had taken place. And one of the nuns pulled me aside. She says, "Katie, I want to talk to you. There's no such thing as mortal sin. You can make up your own mind, you know." And she opened up this whole thing. And at the same time, I had three different Catholic priests come on to me. "Won't you come home with me? I'm so lonely." And I thought, "You fucking hypocrite." And then I saw the hypocrisy, the bigotry, the misogyny, and then the child sexual abuse is still being worse. So there was a lot of lies and deception. My parting year at Merrillhurst College, which was a good place to be, I could go and clean up the altar and get everything ready for the priest, but but then I had to leave because I wasn't worthy to be a priest. Okay, so I went up one afternoon in the chapel because I knew it would be empty, and I got everything out, and I said the mass. I did the host, I did the wine, I did the whole thing, and I put it all back because I had to clean up, you know, and I knew where it all went, and I'm still alive to tell the tale. So that was my way of breaking my freedom away from the misogyny. And Mike, I have to thank you for gathering us together
Oh.
because you're including women's voices, which at the time in the 50s and early 60s, we didn't have a voice. We had no voice. We were told what to do. That came later in the 60s and 70s. So as I went through the rest of my life, I divorced the Catholic Church big time. And a priest said, "You better come to confession to me." And I said, "Look, you come to the confession to me." And he didn't know what to say. So off I went. And I was teaching in Seattle, teaching music, choirs, you know, involved in stuff. And I did meet, get involved with Eastern tradition, kind of like Buddhism, meditation, and chanting. And that had heart. Like Thich Nhat Hanh, I knew about him and studied his stuff. So that felt true to me. I used to run into people and they say, "Yeah, I'm a recovering Catholic too." What was referred to as recovering Catholics. So that, and the influence though, I love ritual. I have a great respect for those who stay in the church and try to do good. Catholic services does try to do good things. And a love for the music and the Gregorian chant, I thought was very beautiful. So I think there's a sacredness there that has been totally watered down and kind of missed over the centuries that could still be there. But I think they did a lot of soul damage. I call it soul murder. And then you have to find your soul as a result afterwards. So I'm not real fond of the Catholic Church, the organization, but I am fond of the little pockets of love that can be found there.
Yeah. So, how much of that wine did you drink when you were saying mass?
Oh, not, they didn't keep much in the, damn it, they didn't keep enough for a party after. Just a wee bit. It was more
When I was an altar boy, we used to sneak it when we could, but you know.
Yeah, much of a chance.
That's probably a mortal sin.
It was, yeah.
Oh yeah, that's bad.
So Carmel, why don't you, Genevieve?
All the way through school, and I agree, indoctrination, I think, is what it comes down to, and much of it was memorization. You know, we had to learn all those things, memorize them, be able to recite them. But I always felt that there was something I wasn't getting or wasn't feeling. I wasn't having a core experience. And I kept looking for it, even all the way through Catholic school. And in my senior year, when the nuns found out that I was going to go to a state college, there was quite a bit of hubbub. Taking, really putting some pressure on my parents, and that was never going to fly because it was my dad's decision and it was happening, period. But what they were saying to me was that if you go to a state college, you lose your faith. You have to have it to lose it, And I actually talked to, when we had the retreat near the end of our senior year, I talked to the priest who handled that retreat and told him what was going on. And he said, "You know what? If you have faith, you will have your faith. It's not dependent on what school you go to. Go where you're headed. If your faith is intact, it will stay that way." Well, yeah. But as I've said, there wasn't a there was a core of ethics there that, yes, straight through me, and an absolute love of some of the ritual. The music. To this day, I miss that. I loved being in the choir. I loved the opportunities we had to sing. But I was barely through my freshman year in college when it was over and behind me. I just stopped. I think right away I stopped going to mass unless I was home on vacation, on vacation or something. And not long after that, I stopped altogether. But there was another part of me that really felt that there was more. There was something, some spiritual something that I wanted, and I really didn't tap into that until my, let me think of how old I was. I think I was in my, probably in my mid-30s, and I just probably had gone into therapy, and the therapist I had been trained in psychosynthesis, which is a transpersonal psychology. And I began to learn about that and ultimately got training in that. And that provided a great deal for me. In fact, I used to look at it as like when you build a house and you have this great frame. And in a way, it's almost like this house that doesn't go past the frame. You get to decide what happens with that house. There's some structure there, there's a lot of information, there are exercises that you can use. And it stayed that way for me ever since. I'm not as closely associated with that anymore, but I simply ha came away from all of that with a core that works for me and a sen a spiritual sense, but not tightly defined. That tight definition put me off for life. And even now, when people approach me and I know they're kind spirited and invite me to come to their church, I'm like, yeah, I kind of don't do an organized religion anymore. So yeah, that's my story.
So, Mary, what are pearls that you can strew before us here?
Well, I was a good Catholic girl. I went to public school for the first through fourth grade, and so then I had to go to catechism on Saturdays, where we memorized the catechism, and then I went to Sacred Heart in the fifth from the fifth grade on, and I just took it as it was. I think I had a deeper spiritual sense, and so I just went through school. I didn't think the I didn't find the academics very challenging, and I would have wished for to be in a more creative and rich educational environment. But at the time, I didn't know any different. So, Sacred Heart and the nuns were what we had. And then my first year of college, I went to Holy Names, which is a Catholic girls' school. And so I was there 1 year, and then I left that and went to Cal State LA. Let's see, is that where I went? Yeah, Cal State LA. And I just drifted away from the church then. I became as I matured, out of high school, I became a seeker. I was looking I was looking for something deeper. I was looking for, I guess, myself. I was looking for my soul, I think. And so I spent years going through a lot of growth kinds of practices and all of which enriched me in some way, and all of which opened me up in some way, and all of which I grew through in some way, and discarded what didn't work for me. And then in the early 90s, I got involved with the spiritual practice that I'm in now. And it's a and so so gosh, that's been what, 40 years or something. Early 80s. No, it was the early 80s. And that was it for me. That was the place for me to be. And so I have a strong spiritual practice. There is a lot going on, lots of classes and workshops and a lot of growth through that. And at one early on when I became part of it, it was said that it attracted a lot of ex-Catholics and ex-Jews. And I think that's the case. People that just grew out of that were looking for something more than they got in the prescribed, the narrow prescribed dogma of religion. So let's see, what else can I say about that? So yeah, I'm very in, yeah, that's my spiritual practice. I don't consider myself, I'm not religious. And it's not a religion, it's spiritual practice. It's about practice. So it's very fulfilling and expansive, and the place for me to be.
Does your spiritual practice or organization, does it have a name?
Yes, it's called the Movement of Spiritual Inner Awareness.
Okay.
And people that don't know would call it a cult, but it's not. It's very independent people, and there's people all over the world that are involved in it. So yeah, Movement of Spiritual Inner Awareness.
I couldn't understand
And
before.
what that means is that basically that we find God and we find our spiritual selves in ourselves.
Yeah.
So there's not dogma. There are teachings and guidance and all this, but there's no have to believe in anything. In fact, my spiritual teacher always said, don't necessarily believe what I say. Check it out and find out for yourself.
Right.
So that's why it draws people that are moving on from more restrictive religious practices.
Mary, I missed the first two words of the name of your place, the something.
Movement of
Movement of.
spiritual awareness.
Oh, okay.
MSIA.
That's one of my teachers said the same thing. Don't take a thing I say. Check it out for yourself. Try it out for yourself. See what works for you.
Exactly. Yes. That's pretty fundamental to our practice.
Now, I don't know if this is too perhaps too personal, but I mean, Katie mentioned it. Were any of you exposed to sort of predatory attempts by the clergy? Yeah.
I
Yeah.
was not.
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
was. I was.
Yeah.
Johnny. Oh yeah. Yeah, it's as a female in a patriarchal society, you're kind of preyed upon at times, especially in the 50s. You really are. You're by the media, by the press, by the those in charge, which was the clergy. And it wasn't just the women, it was the kids.
Yeah.
So that aspect of some of the behavior, not all, has my hair on fire still because of the denial and the put it aside and move the priest around. So I'm pretty disgusted with that.
Well, I want to say that I was exposed to something with a neighbor of mine when I was very young. I was probably 4 or so, 4 or 5. And it was something I was very uncomfortable with, and I just froze him out. I didn't allow anything to happen because I knew that I didn't have any safe place to go to talk to anybody about it.
Yeah.
And I think that became my strategy. So
Yes,
I think that I put that out, and so I didn't. I don't think I don't think I looked like potential.
well, that's pretty smart for a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
Well, it's just kind of an automatic.
Yeah, bless your heart.
I thought that, as I remember, a lot of the religious instruction, so-called, was done by the priests. They would come into the classrooms and give us lectures and what have you.
Yeah,
I
religion.
remember,
And I'm laughing because sometimes those were an absolute joke. They had so little to do with learning anything.
Oh,
I
yeah.
can remember one that was in a sort of upstairs and more back kind of room, and which it was one of the younger priests,
Yep.
and it was just a put up hour.
I'm thinking, Mike, I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
You had that Catholic upbringing yourself. And then you had the unfortunate O'Day experience, and then you went to Vietnam. Did anything from that Catholic upbringing sustain you in your heart while you were undergoing what must have been a horrific experience?
Well, I would credit my parents for their example and their teaching. And my mother was a school teacher. My dad was a railroad man, but they were both literate people. And the values that I still have, I got from them about basically justice, and what is right and what's wrong, supporting, My dad did not. I mean, he grew up with, for one thing, he grew up with a lot of Indians, and they grew up in Minnesota. And he actually, his dad was a federal agent or a federal officer on an Indian reservation, Chippewa Indian Reservation in Minnesota, Catholic Minnesota. So he was very comfortable with Indians. And I think because of that, I was very comfortable with the Indians that were in school too, and playing against Indians in Chiloquin and what have you. So. As you probably remember, the Klamath Falls was not a particularly friendly place for Indians. When they sold off part of their reservation, there was a lot of some of the merchants who really took advantage of them and their newfound wealth. So, but no, I my values, my core values were given to me or instilled in me by my parents, and religion didn't have anything to do with it, quite frankly. My dad was a strong union supporter. He was a member of the union, and my mother was a school teacher, and those are the, since I had a couple of almost years before I went to Vietnam, I ended up in Vietnam because I got drafted, and I got drafted because I flunked out of college twice and lost my student deferment. So, but I mean, before that, I was a reader of history in particular, and I sort of generally knew that war was not a good thing, and I didn't want to go.
Yeah.
So,
One of
I have to say, though, that just about nothing, almost nothing, prepares you for the experience of being in a war or even just witnessing a war, which I sort of did both. But yeah, so. What happened after I got back was that I was very angry and very sad and confused, and I think that what was saving us for on a spiritual level, what saved me was getting involved in the anti-war movement and giving a direction to myself. That didn't really solve a lot of problems. And I'll give this when Fallujah that was that. Huge fight that was involved with that, and I was seeing that on TV, and I had another occurrence of PTSD, and in my case it was like a slide of images that I remember from the war, and I went to the VA and they actually got that stopped. And you don't really trauma, you never really forget it, but you can get to some a point where you can live with it. And so that's, and part of that was actually writing. And I don't know if I can emphasize that too much. There's one of this counselor that I've talked to, and I wrote a piece, maybe some of you have seen it, it's called The May Girl, but it was a traumatic sort of episode that during the Tet Offensive, and the village next to us was basically destroyed, and some of the people came over and tried to get help from us, and we couldn't give them any help. But so I wrote this piece, and he said, I showed it to him. He says, "Well, that's good." He says, "Now write it again." And I've written it, over the years, many sort of times. That sort of, it's not really re-experiencing, but it actually, by doing the act of writing, it takes the pain out of it, or the anger out of it too, which is, and now it's a pretty recognized as a pretty standard sort of form of therapy for a
Oh, it's
trauma,
big.
and it does work really. It's quite useful. I don't know if that answers your question, Kathy.
I don't think the Catholic doctrine served you when you were in the middle of that war, but your heart certainly did serve you, so that's good.
Yeah, especially the Catholic doctrine, they're virulent anti-communism. And I was an interrogator linguist. I went to language school, but I ended up being an interrogator. And I didn't beat anybody up. Some of my comrades did, unfortunately. But what that allowed me to do was to actually talk to many, many dozens of these people and see them as people. And also, I was lucky enough to be able to. Because what I did, and also had the what limited what language ability I did have, talked to Vietnamese and the same thing, react, recognize them, and interact with them, and it was quite frankly not something that many soldiers were allowed to have because they were busy staying alive and shooting people. So I'm grateful for that, and I, it's, that allowed me to. Went back to Vietnam 10 years ago, and quite a few people. One of them were eight National Liberation Front soldiers, so-called Viet Cong. I met them and interviewed them, and they wrote this book. And it's published in Vietnamese and English. And basically, it's just their stories. I told them I wasn't writing another thing about the war. I just wanted to hear their stories, and it took a little convincing for them to believe me. That's what I wanted to do, but they did, you'll see. It's actually a very interesting book, if I do say so myself, and certainly unusual in a sense, it's not another veteran saying, "Jesus Christ, I went to this firefight and I had to kill these people." Blah 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 blah. They're literally, as I went through these sort of thousands of books about Vietnam written by Americans, very few of them have anything to do with what the other side was saying or doing, So I'd say it's been a journey, and unfortunately, from my perspective or from anybody's perspective, the lessons that we could have learned in Vietnam, we didn't learn. We haven't learned in Afghanistan or Iraq, and the same sort of lives are being thrown away. Yet we've got, I went and looked at our annuals or our yearbooks, and I think that there's about 11 or 12 of our male comrades who were in the military. One for sure I know died after it, Doug Murray. He killed himself. And because I think his experience in Vietnam, and two or three other guys were in Vietnam too. I think Phil Anderson, Hurley, Elmo. Yeah. I talked to Elmo a number of years ago, and I didn't want anything to do with the VA, so I was talking to him about that. And he says, "Oh, Mike," he says, "you're entitled to everything you it doesn't make any what you did is the military, but you're entitled that you spent." time in the military, and then Elmo told me, he says his last year in the military, I think he was in the Marines, they had him come back to the States and bring all those dead Indians back to the reservations. That was his job for a year. Well, I mean, for all the reservations. And so, but I'm grateful to Elmo that, because it got me into the VA, which you may not know, but perhaps you do, that it's actually excellent health care. I never thought that 32 months in the Army would be worth a damn, but it turns out that it's worth quite a bit as far as health care goes. I get excellent. I got two knees,
Oh,
major
you're
surgery
kidding.
yesterday, a year ago, and walking and talking, you know. So, Katie, you have a brother who was there, right?
Would just want to mention, Tom, I took a few notes while I was getting ready for our call, and my handwriting almost turned into Tom's handwriting.
Oh.
It's kind of interesting. So he's here in some way. He went to Catholic school. He was a pianist. He got drafted, and we had to drive him up to Fort Lewis in the car. And we didn't know why. We didn't know what it was for, but it was supposed to go, and he was drafted. So I've never forgotten sitting in the car with him and my dad, pulling into Fort Lewis, and he was terrified, but it was all silence, right? And then he got out of the car, and I didn't see him again for 4 years or so. They got him into officers' training program because he had a college degree, but he also was a concert pianist at the time. And they said, "Well, we want you to be an officer, and you take this gun and you're going to go out and shoot these people." He said, "No, I'm not. I will not do that." So something in his heart, and he was a musician, so I can't kill people. So they put him in they called it the AmeriCal division. And I don't know how it works, but they would fly him and others into combat zones, and the helicopters would be shot at and rockets fly. So he never knew when he got in that helicopter whether he'd come home again or not. But he would go into combat zones and the bullets flying and play music for the troops, and then they'd fly him out. He did witness but did not take part in the My Lai massacre, and that destroyed his soul. And they brought him home and they debriefed the hell out of him. He never said a word about it, but he just said he'd saw it, and then he would go somewhere. He would disassociate and go somewhere. So his soul was shattered, and even though he was a concert pianist, he continued to play and work. He went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, graduated there, came
Wow.
back. Yeah, and came back. But he was self-medicating because at that time, the Vietnam vets were not treated very well. They came back and they were kind of blamed for being in the war, for they had nothing to do with. Why were they there in the first place? Can anybody give me a clear answer? So he started self-medicating with alcohol and drugs, and that went on a long time. I lost touch with him for about 10 years. He was never, after that, able to take care of himself. So systemically, the burden fell on my parents to give him money. And he would call and ask for money. He would call and ask me for money. He'd always have a problem of some kind. Of course, the drinking didn't help that. But he kept playing his music. And what struck me the most about it, he was a very generous, loving, talented, soft, beautiful human being who was shattered by this war inside. So no, he didn't die there, but he died
Yeah.
anyway. And I can see that there were several systems that were affected by the Vietnam War. I'll just mention a few. The political system, our country was at odds. The Veterans Administration was revolutionized by the need that came back towards them. And the families, myself, my parents, the wives, all were impacted by veterans who came back with their problems, with their pain. And so when I see the Vietnam War Memorial in DC, I see a raw wound of death and destruction and pain. 52,000, 54,000 people. And then I also see deep sacrifice. And I keep thinking, rich man's war, poor man's blood. So I became more of a political activist after that. I worked for civil rights, Equal Rights Amendment, Japanese redress, and anti-war demonstration as a result of what happened to my brother. Yeah. So he
Well, thank
passed
you.
away a couple years ago. Yeah. He ended up in a nursing home, couldn't ever take care of himself. So I took care of all of his legal stuff up until the time he died. But he still had the sweetest heart. A week before he died, he was in a nursing home. It was in December, and he was still playing piano for people. Still. And then a week later, he died. And I thought, that's the beauty. That's the spirit that Mary was talking about, the inner spirit of love and beingness. And he was able to demonstrate that for others in spite of this, what I still think was a horrific war. So, okay, done. God bless you, Tom, wherever you are.
Joni and Genevieve, Harry, you probably have friends and or relatives that were in the war.
You know, in my case, not so many, not relatives, but sort of in later years, I met a man. I was actually living in a Forest Service camp in Eastern Oregon, and I met a fellow who has remained my friend many, many years, and I have so much respect for him. He was in Vietnam. He's an artist, and he studied at the Chicago Art Institute. And then he got drafted and was sent to Vietnam and went feeling like he was doing the right thing. But he was shot up really severely, kept him for a while there in a hospital, and then brought him back to stateside. And I think he was in the hospital for quite a long time, long, long arc of recovery. And when I met him, I think he was still struggling a lot. And he talked a lot about nightmares and his wife talked about that he would wake up screaming in the night. Tom was one of those wonderful people who kept searching, and he got involved with a veterans group and I think became sort of a leader in that group. And he's, I really look at him as one of the most, it just, that work brought out the best of him. He's such a positive person now and so healed. And he's been through a lot. I kind of lost track of him for a couple of years. And then, but I reached out to him, and his response to me is, well, the summer of 68 isn't done with me yet. He had been in a VA hospital being treated for Agent Orange related cancer. But that's probably maybe 10 years ago, and he's still alive and living in Baker, Oregon, and really a prolific artist and a really positive force in his community, too. So, I mean, that's just my best story about Vietnam. He was a wonderful person who was able to take the worst of it and make it into something better.
Yeah.
Well, my husband was in the Navy in Vietnam, but he never was in a war zone at all. So he was, I mean, he's fine. But I remember working at First National Bank in Klamath, and a fellow who was a couple of years younger than us came in and I think opened up a savings account or something. And it was during the Vietnam War. I think that was probably about 1968. And the next thing I knew, read in the paper that he had been shot and killed in Vietnam, and he had just arrived. Just arrived. And I thought that was pretty sad. And then I remember I had been dating a young man for a couple of years. And we went to OIT together, and he left for Vietnam. And when he came home one night, I wasn't there, and the phone rang, and my dad answered it and found out it was him. And he wasn't very nice to him because he was in the Vietnam War. And I thought that was terrible. Because what, I mean, your country calls you to do something, and then you come back home, and people don't like you for what you did, you know, and that wasn't your fault at all. And he is still alive, living in Klamath. I haven't seen him in 50 some years or more than that. But yeah, I felt sorry for all those fellas that have come home and had to go through a lot of things like you, Mike, you know, you what you went through and stuff. And it just makes me sad.
Well, let me just say just quickly that I was involved with the anti-war movement as an anti-war veteran. I was at that time a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And incidentally, Joni, it says everybody who puts on a uniform and or picks up a gun is nobody gets away from that with scot-free. And if your husband was in Navy off Vietnam, he was in the war. I mean, he was. But I mean, let's see, where's I going with this? As a member of the Vietnam Veterans and anti-war veteran, the anti-war movement in particular was very deferential and treated us veterans with a lot of respect and thanks. Now, that may not have been true for all Americans, clearly, with Joni's remarks. But many people did. So.
Well, I didn't know anyone who went to Vietnam. My brother Mick was 2 years younger than me. He managed to avoid the draft. I think he was called up, but he had some kind of condition that got him out of it, for which I'm grateful. So, and I didn't really know anyone else that was in the war, and I honestly didn't pay a lot of attention to it. I was just kind of in my own, just doing my own thing in those years. But the more I learned about it, the more I became, I guess I would say, anti-war, that it's just, the insanity of it, and it keeps happening over and over again. It's just such a waste. It's so destructive, and it's when will humanity learn? I guess I'm blessed not to have had, really close relationship with anybody. I'm in a Rotary Club now, and there is one fellow who was a veteran, and he's involved in organizing honor flights for veterans to go back to Washington, D.C. and be treated, be able to see the memorials, and just be kind of get some respect and some appreciation that they may not have gotten, and when they return from wherever they went. So we actually have an honorary member of our club who's a veteran of the Korean War. He's in his early 90s. He was wounded, and pretty amazing guy. And anyway, the honor flights are one way, I think, veterans are just trying to stand up and help each other, to know that what they did was honored, and to support them in
Yeah.
this journey to the memorials.
Well, I've always asked people who say, "Well, thank you for your service," to say, "Welcome home," rather than thank you for your service, because what some of us did in the war or otherwise is not something that we're particularly proud of. And I think that many veterans are kind of tired of the cliche, which is it has become that. That's one thing. I can't remember what I was going to say otherwise.
For the welcome home.
Well, yeah, the Veterans for Peace, our chapter here, and a couple other chapters in the area, every year we march with about 100 or so plus other entrants in the Auburn Veterans Day Parade, which they bill themselves as the largest Veterans Day parade west of the Mississippi. I don't know if that's true, but it's a big, big, big parade. Now, when we first started there, we've been down there 16 or 17 years. And when we first started there, some of the people, turned their backs on us and that sort of thing. That's not the case anymore. They thank us, come out of their way to thank us for being there and clap for us. And it's actually quite a heartening experience. We're the only peace and justice activist anti-war group in the parade. It's mostly Boy Scouts and drill teams and everything else. So it's but everybody understands what we are and appreciate it. I think there's a different tone in people's reactions now, especially after, I mean, 20 years in Afghanistan and we're still in Iraq and the only lesson the military learned from Vietnam was that don't let the media cover your war. So,
Oh, I'm sorry. I find myself reflecting on all of this because as time went on, I went back to school, got a master's degree, became a therapist, and worked primarily with victims of sexual assault, some depression, and domestic violence. And although I didn't experience any predatory things while I was in school, before I ever started school, I was sexually abused by a young man in our neighborhood. And actually, practically every child in that neighborhood was sexually abused by him. And so there were things that I didn't even know I had there to sort out. I mean, I knew about the experience, but I didn't know about the lifelong effect of trauma in that way. And so that's where my training took me. But I just find myself reflecting on the disparity. I remember in school, and Michael, you probably remember this because the boys were just seemed taken with war and tactics and various battles. There was a real strong interest in the wars when we studied history. And it's kind of like as a people, and maybe all peoples do this, divorce ourselves from the psychic murder that goes on, the damage we do to our own people who then have to come back and may never be able to share their experiences and wouldn't even want to with their families because it's been so horrifying. And it's just like, what do you mean by that? I think it's just heartbreaking, that aspect of it.
Well, it's my opinion, and probably not an original opinion, but I think that it's because either because of the personal reticence of discussing a war for somebody who's been to a war, or for society's preference, they don't want to hear stories like this, that had there been more of a venue or an opportunity for veterans to talk about the war and be encouraged to talk about the war, that would have a damping effect, I think, on actually the ability for people to go to war, and also maybe a damping effect on the rah-rah sort of militarisms that this country has a lot of. So, unfortunately, we don't have that sort of option, although it's better than it was, because for our parents or grandparents, it was not something that they talked about at all. For the World War II and Korean veterans, that was they just didn't never did it, and I remember this one guy talking about, or somebody reading, was a short story about this dad who was they were driving, and he was a World War II veteran. He was driving and some explosion or something like that happened. He was out of that car and in the ditch, and I here I am, an 80-year-old man, and I leave town when the Blue Angels come, if I can possibly do it. And I hate fireworks on the 4th of July and New Year's. I mean, I've gotten into huge brawls with some of my neighbors about this. Not physical brawls, but too much so that I was on social, their low neighborhood social comment about this crazy guy who was yelling. And it's a physiological sort of reaction. It's not that, being around a lot of explosions and you just don't lose it.
No,
I wish it was not the case, but you don't just don't lose it. Some people are affected more or less than others, but that's one of those things, when people say, "Well, you don't like the Blue Angels, why is that?" Well, I spent an afternoon watching them kill a couple of hundred civilians, that's the reason a lot of veterans don't like them either. Although many say, "Well, this is they're wonderful, wonderful." There's a real disconnect, or not disconnect, but a sort of conflict of sort of experience, if that's the right word, between many veterans and people who are like myself, who don't really have much use for it, and the sort of like the getting together with your old buddies is not something that I had any desire to do, and although many people do, so it's, I suppose you can take what you can out of it.
So, Michael, do you think that the work you're doing with Veterans Act for Peace is making a little bit of a dent in that disconnect, awakening people to just a little bit, or is it
Well,
more than?
it does, because one of the things I'm privileged to do is to actually go into schools. And including, kindergarten through eight schools, and talk, however briefly, I sort of tone it down a little bit. But I recently went to, there's a Catholic school here in Magnolia, Blaine, and I went up there and I just wrote, I read a piece that I've written about the way Veterans Day was changed from an Armistice Day. Armistice Day used to be, which honored the end of First World War, the 11th hour, the 11th day, the 11th month, and how that became morphed into Veterans Day. But the thing that was interesting about the original Armistice Day was that the official language, and that's from the government's language of the proclamation of Armistice Day, it included, it says the day should be marked with expressions of peace and brotherhood. That's not something that unfortunately, the VFW, the American Legion, or for that matter, the proclamations about you hear about Veterans Day. So I was reading this thing, a very relatively short thing, and there were kindergartners. There were 400 kids in this giant classroom. They had kindergartners sitting up front, squirreling away, and then all the way to eighth graders. And they sent me, and I don't have it with me, a afterwards they sent me a I'm going to find that and I'll put it on the on our send it to you, but they sent me this 8.5 by 11 thing with these scrawled, adolescent, barely legible remarks about saying, "Oh, my dad was in World War II, and he was, it was so sad," or the, "I love you." Couple of things that they said, "I love you," other things, and they're, they thank me for being there, and so that sort of a response is something that I really appreciate, and it's happened with our high school kids too. One of the things we do in the high schools is go on when the military is there and says, "Do you think you know everything you need to know about getting in the military?" And we've got sort of a little poop sheet about that sort of thing. And they're kids. They don't know much about anything. It's interesting, as you might appreciate this, that the girls in the school, they're much more hip to the issues than the boys are. One of the things are, is because that the military. The rate of sexual assault to mostly women in the military is just horrendous. It's awful in this country generally, but they realize, they do pick up on the military and the boys. They're high school boys. They're brain dead anyway. Just about. So it's, although not all, there are some smart kids. Actually, I'm much impressed with the younger generation of that era. They're pretty smart kids, and really, in many ways, I think they're smarter than certainly I was at that age.
A lot of our classmates that got drafted, they were just kids too.
Yeah.
They didn't know what was coming.
So we had, I think there were like 18 males in the class or something like that. So 10 or 12 of them were in the military. And the reason I mention that is because when I went to O'Day, which is much, much bigger school, there were several hundred in the senior class. I only know of two or three that actually went in the military. But again, that's a class thing. A lot of our classmates were not particularly well off. I mean, they're okay, but they weren't. Some of these kids that went to O'Day, a much more expensive school, they had more better offerings about getting out of the draft, for one thing. It's a class thing, and that's still true. They call the current sort of way of going in the military the poverty draft, because it's mostly people who don't have options otherwise that end up in the military trying to get some education out of it. And that's one of the things we talked about to the kids. He says, it's not so easy. You gotta spend a lot of time in the military to get any benefits. That's assuming that you don't end up with PTSD or get killed or end up shooting somebody or getting raped or,
So, in your experience in Vietnam, were there any women nurses, soldiers? What was your experience?
We didn't see any. I mean, they were called, anybody says it was the experience we called Americans, women, round eyes. And because it's the other women were not round eyes. And it was my best experience with a American woman in Vietnam was I was hitchhiking from my barracks down to where I worked, it was down this road full of Vietnamese, and somebody stopped us. And this pickup truck driven by this staff sergeant, she was a woman, and she opened the door, and first thing I saw was her legs. She was driving barefoot with nylons on, and then I looked, okay. And then I saw her patch. First thing I saw was her legs, and then her rank. And she said, "Hop in, soldier. Where are you going?" So she just drove me down there. We had a little chit chat, and she was such an attractive, I'd say 40 or so years old, but she was, not so much a thing of an experience, but vivid. And the other one is going to these really awful sort of USO shows with Bob Hope. I was with First Infantry Division, and looking back from left field, and there was what's her name? Not who was the most famous she's a movie star.
Marilyn Monroe.
No, Marilyn Monroe. It dates you.
Yeah.
No, it was like Raquel Welch or one of those. I think it might have been her. And she was just, doing a little dance on the stage, and Bob Hope is making these bad jokes, and all the GIs are just yelling and crazy. There were several thousand GIs straining to see something. That's it.
No.
Occasionally, if I'd been up to, I'd go up to what they call Pentagon East and see another unlisted woman, but it was
Yeah. Not there. Not there.
USO. USO. Sometimes we call them the donut dollies. They were called.
Oh, sexism alive and well in the military.
Well, no, really. You have to realize it's 1968.
Oh, God, yeah.
So let me say thank you, Joni, Genevieve Radha, and Mary, for showing up. Classmates, it was great to see you and talk to you. And hopefully this won't be the last time I talk to you. So this is the KOD. This show will be broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. Seattle. And thanks again to my contestants, if you want to call it that.